Okay, well, welcome back. Lovely to have you back here. This is going to be hopefully a little refreshing because I think maybe yesterday was a lot of really sobering history of how we've gotten to where we are today and the sheer challenge of what lies ahead. Now I want to dive into the Sustainable Development Goals and get you a sense of where we are right now. And believe it or not, that's gonna be less discouraging. Instead of me doing this on my own, I'm gonna have start with a very quick, an excerpt from a TED Talk. Michael Green is a really crucial person in, and why is this not playing? Play. In this sphere, so I'll leave it to him.
Do you think the world is going to be a better place next year? In the next decade? Can we end hunger, achieve gender equality, halt climate change, all in the next 15 years? Well, according to the governments of the world, yes, we can. In the last few days, the leaders of the world, meeting at the UN in New York, agreed a new set of global goals for the development of the world to 2030. And here they are. These goals are the product of a massive consultation exercise. The global goals are who we, humanity, want to be. Now that's the plan, but can we get there? Can this vision for a better world really be achieved? Well, I'm here today because we've run the numbers, and the answer, shockingly, is that maybe we actually can, but not with business as usual. Now, the idea that the world is going to get a better place may seem a little fanciful. Watch the news every day and the world seems to be going backwards, not forwards. And let's be frank, it's pretty easy to be sceptical about grand announcements coming out of the UN. But please, I invite you to suspend your disbelief for just a moment. Because back in 2001, the UN agreed another set of goals, the Millennium Development Goals. And the flagship target there was to halve the proportion of people living in poverty by 2015. The target was to take from a baseline of 1990, when 36% of the world's population lived in poverty, to get to 18% poverty this year. Did we hit this target? Well, no, we didn't. We exceeded it. This year, global poverty is going to fall to 12%. Now, that's still not good enough, and the world does still have plenty of problems. But the pessimists and doomsayers who say that the world can't get better are simply wrong. So how did we achieve the success? Well, a lot of it was because of economic growth. Some of the biggest reductions in poverty were in countries such as China and India, which have seen rapid economic growth in recent years. So can we pull off the same trick again? Can economic growth get us to the global goals? Well, to answer that question, we need to benchmark where the world is today against the global goals and figure out how far we have to travel. But that ain't easy, because the global goals aren't just ambitious, they're also pretty complicated. Of the 17 goals, there are then 169 targets and literally hundreds of indicators. Also, while some of the goals are pretty specific, end hunger, others are a lot vaguer, promote peaceful and tolerant societies. So to help us with this benchmarking, I'm going to use a tool called the Social Progress Index.
And that's where I'm going to cut off Michael Green. And we'll actually come back to the Social Progress Index just in a little bit, but I don't think I'll have him explain it to you. So here we are. Welcome back. Here are our Sustainable Development Goals, our 17 goals. I am Jim Bolter at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Well, I'm not there. I'm here in Holden Village, but most often I find myself at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and my pronouns are he and him. And I'm really pleased to have you back here so we can further this conversation. Now, there are a lot of indicators. Remember, I talked yesterday, for those of you who were here, about how I would be dividing them into three basic groups here. Biosphere is what we didn't get to yesterday. Society as advertised is what we're going to be focusing on today. And tomorrow we'll look at economy, and we'll also look at biosphere, which is kind of a nice sort of 1-2 punch of maybe conflicting priorities. So I think that'll be a nice way to wrap them up. And it gives us 8 each time. Now, these are the 8 we're going to be looking at today. And as I said, these are the ones that are more or less under the heading, subject heading of social or society-related sustainable development goals. And they include end of poverty, end of hunger, good health and well-being across the globe, quality education for all, gender equality, affordable and clean energy, sustainable cities and communities, and peace, justice, and strong institutions, a pretty broad target. Now, Michael Green was speaking in 2015 when the United Nations had just passed an overwhelmingly accepted the Sustainable Development Goals as a United Nations. A few things have happened since 2015. Can any of you think of some things maybe that have happened since 2015 that may have affected our ability to satisfactorily meet those goals? What's one? Just shout one out.
COVID.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, any others?
Trump was invading Ukraine.
Trump, yeah, as the United States is a major player in global negotiations, we as a nation, we kind of stepped back, right? You said earlier?
Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Right, war in Ukraine, yep.
Withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Withdrawal from Afghanistan, right? Any others?
Political divisiveness.
Political divisiveness here, certainly, but in other countries as well. We're seeing some shifts in power around the world. Any others?
Climate-induced migration.
Climate-induced migration, and frankly, a lot of climate-induced stuff, droughts and storms, extreme weather, extreme heat, and so forth. Right, so we're actually, for today, what we're going to do is I'm going to walk you through these 8 briefly, highlighting some of what has happened as of 2019. Why 2019? Pre-COVID, pre-Ukraine, right? And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to break you into groups, and I'm going to give you some resources and allow you in small groups to sort of dig into and understand what the latest numbers are telling us. And then we'll look at some of these online data sources because they're really interesting. Okay, so what I'm going to be showing you here, for the most part, are measured in 2019. That's an important caveat, right? Because I want you to be able to have an opportunity to see the contrast pre and post COVID, because it turns out COVID's a pretty important impact. And so here are some statistics, right? And Michael Green kind of highlighted this, right? In 1950, there were 1.6 billion people living in extreme poverty, and only 924 million people not in extreme poverty. That is 63% of the world's population were in extreme poverty. By 2015, however, there were 733 million people living in extreme poverty and 6.6 billion people not living in extreme poverty. So even as the world's population increased by a substantial fraction, we see overall far fewer people in poverty. Still way too many, it should be made clear, right? And we can see this, of course, on a graph here, and even if you project out to 2030, back in 2019, we still see maybe 6%, an improvement over 10, and we're going to see how COVID affected that number. Interestingly, not only this many people living in extreme poverty in 2015, but really the lion's share of those actually in sub-Saharan Africa. So we have a geography to match our challenge. How about end hunger, zero hunger? That's a good goal, right? So is there any good news? I mean, there's some bad news, certainly. You know, actually more people are living in hunger in 2017 than in 2015. And you can imagine that number has, and I'm sure you've seen the reporting, has increased dramatically since then by 2022, largely in response to COVID and certainly in response to the war in Ukraine, the incursion into Ukraine. And so we see an increase in the number of people living in hunger. Now, additionally, it should be noted that the population continues to rise in that period of time as well. Who are the people who are, and what are the impacts of well, actually, let's, right? Fascinatingly, substantial portion of those who are, suffer from hunger are actually agricultural workers, which is simultaneously tragic and somewhat ironic, perhaps, but maybe not too surprising, because resource extraction tends to be underpaid. But there is some good news too, right? From the period of 1961 to 2014, the global per capita supply of protein has increased by about one third, rising from 61 grams per person to 81 grams. Most of this has come in Africa, Asia, and South America, which is good news because these are places in which undernutrition was actually exacerbated by a lack of adequate access to protein. The per capita supply of protein in North America was 60% higher than in Africa in 2014. In terms of calories, 40% higher than in Africa. Let's dive into this a little bit further here. Here we're seeing now, this is a different source of data, not the United Nations. This is from a fascinating, I don't know, has anyone ever gone to Our World in Data? Google that sometime. You can just put in a keyword and you can find data on all sorts of fascinating topics, all of which are well sourced and cited. This is from the food, the UN FAO data source. And what's fascinating here to me is China, where we see the daily caloric intake rising from about 1,500 calories per day to over 3,000 calories per day. And they really went from below most low-income countries really to match the upper-income countries around the world. So we see a huge driver of this increased caloric intake really being from China. Interestingly, in the United States, this is kind of fascinating. We surpassed the United Kingdom in about 1970 or so. And then we hit a peak and this started to decline. Anyone want to make a guess what happened right about here in the United States? The recession, yeah. We actually see a decrease in caloric intake due to the change in economy and then a bit of a resurgence, but we never returned to that high point there. Kind of interesting.
4,000 calories?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, 3,700 calories. It's a lot. If we look worldwide, I think this is a really, sort of informative chart. It does give us a sense of where in the world we're eating, you know, the largest number of calories are being consumed. Let's move on to SDG 3, ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. Again, there's some good news here, right? In 1950, the global life expectancy was 46 years old. Wow. 65 years later now, 72 years old. That's a great improvement. In the same time period, child mortality dropped from 225 per 1,000 down to 45 per 1,000. An enormous improvement. Here's some other statistics. You can see them. Under five deaths dropping substantially from 2000 to 2017. Tuberculosis incident rates decreasing substantially. And even HIV among adults in sub-Saharan Africa, a dramatic improvement in HIV infection rates. Some really good news in the world of health on the global scale. Let's put this in a little broader context. If we look back to 1850, yeah, it's a long ways to look back. Interestingly, the United States only starts in about 1930 do we have data. And so we can see the United States here in sort of magenta. If it actually parallels UK pretty well, so we can follow the UK back to maybe a childhood mortality rate of about 25%. In much of the developed world. But we can look at countries like India and Brazil as maybe emblematic of the global south. And we see dramatic decreases in childhood mortality that even a country like India, which has a relatively high child mortality rate globally, down to 5%. Extraordinary improvements. quality education. Some more good news. Between 1940 and 2015, the percentage of adults around the world who could read and write doubled. Wow, that's fantastic. And remember, this is the percentage. Remember, in absolute terms, the number of people around the world that can read and write has really increased because the population has increased substantially in that same period of time. However, 750 million adults still remain illiterate, and see how this relates to other SDGs. Two-thirds of them, unfortunately, sadly, are women. Of course, this is primarily in the developing world, right, that we see that differentiation. One out of five children between age six and 17 years are not still attending school. And more than half of the schools in sub-Saharan Africa really don't have access to much in the way of technology, computers, internet, but even things like basic drinking water and hand washing facilities. Still some ways to go, but still improvements with ways to go. How about gender equality? Well, we have some challenges here, right? There is some good news, however. This is still far too low. It should be about double that, right? Of 24% of national parliamentarians or essentially the equivalent of members of Congress are women. That's an increase, you can't read this, from 19% in 2010. So that's a big jump upwards in a short period of time. So that's a very positive trajectory, right?
Question about that.
Yeah.
That seems like a goal that some nations, certainly some cultures, might not agree with.
Probably so.
But was that... Are these things all, you say they're passed by the UN, agreed to, is there like dissension or competing points of view that are expressed along the way?
I'm sure there are, right? Yeah. But in the end, there are, my guess, and this is merely, as I say, conjecture, is that there are so many goals, right? And that many of these countries would benefit from so many that they might just simply hold their nose and let the package pass, right? You're right, but there are some cultural barriers to this in some parts of the world, to this increasing substantially. Some really sobering statistics here, right? Physical and sexual partner violence. Over the previous 12 months, 18% of women and girls aged 15 to 49, a truly horrific and shocking number. On the other hand, in Southern Asia, a girl's risk of marrying in childhood has decreased 40% since 2000. Again, some cultural conflict potentially in some of these numbers, improving some of these numbers, but still, 30% of women aged 20 to 24 years married before age 18. We see a difference here, and we're going to see this not, this is, you know, some of these numbers here apply as much to the developed world as the developing world. Women represent globally 39% of the workforce, but only 27% of managerial positions, right? So clearly some ways to go on gender equality. Moving on to affordable and clean energy, we see some very good news here in terms of a social outcome, right? 9 out of 10 people worldwide now have access to electricity. That's a stunningly large number. But only 17.5% of that total final energy consumption comes from renewable sources. We'll look more into that in just a moment. This is really good. This is called decoupling, right? So by and large, over the history of these data being collected, there has been a strong correlation between national GDP and the amount of energy that country consumes. The more energy it consumes, the higher their GDP, the greater their wealth. That is, there was a one-to-one correlation almost between the consumption of energy and the creation of wealth. The United States has been an enormous beneficiary of this trend. The question for the planet is, can we continue to create GDP without as needing as much energy? So can we be more efficient? And the corollary would be, can we continue to create energy without emitting carbon dioxide, right? This is a link to SDG 13, which is climate action. Well, this is an example of decoupling here, because now we're getting more efficient at using energy. That 2.3% less energy annually is required per US dollar of economic output. And that's a really positive trend.
Is that constant dollars or inflation in dollars?
I would have to look at I'm sure I could find that, and I'd be happy to check into it and get back to you, but I don't know. I would imagine, I would be surprised if they didn't use constant dollars. That would be weird, right? Because they use purchasing power parity to levelize nations, so it would be weird if they didn't make that correction. I would hope so, yeah. But I can't tell you for sure, right? But still, 3 billion people lack clean cooking fuels and technology, and this is a real concern because it leads to really poor air quality, particularly indoor air quality, which kills... which is responsible for the premature deaths of millions of people annually, and of course, disproportionately women and young children. So that's a great concern. Let's dig into this energy thing. So I'm a total energy geek, and so we're just doing this for my benefit. Enjoy the ride. Right, so if we look at the kinds of renewables, right, the vast majority of our renewables right now, and this camp is a good example of it, is hydropower, right? But wind is expanding rapidly and has been for some time. Solar really is now taking over, and there are some other renewables besides. Let's dig in a little further. Where does all our electricity come from? This is according to the International Energy Agency. Sorry, the attribution's not on the slide, the IEA. And we can see that our electricity still overwhelmingly globally comes from coal. This is a problem. But however, look at the trend here. We can see natural gas trending upward as coal begins its downward dive, certainly doing so strongly in the United States. But we can see that natural gas and renewables are kind of duking it out here, even as nuclear and oil. Now, this is electricity. This is not total energy consumption. This is purely for creation of electricity. And by and large, we have not, we don't use a lot of oil for electricity generation. We see a decrease in nuclear. More on that in just a second. What is driving these? This is an extraordinary graph. I love this. This is the price of electricity from new power plants. So if you build a new power plant and you amortize the cost of operating that power plant, so this is called the levelized cost of energy, LCOE. If you look at this, solar used to be super expensive. Look at its trend from 2009 to 2019. It went from the most expensive form of energy to the tying for the least expensive energy with onshore wind. Onshore wind is also decreasing, but not even gas can beat solar now. And this is why we see so much solar, even from utility scale solar. Coal is about the same price, but it's getting badly beat by gas and also the renewables, wind and solar. Solar thermal, which are the big, huge towers you might see out in the desert southwest of the United States, where you see thousands of mirrors all focused through a single solar tower, are really good sources of energy, but still rather expensive. And nuclear actually is increasing in price for new nuclear facilities. That's an important element to this, and still substantially more expensive. Yeah, so... if you look at the total consumption of energy, who's consuming energy? Now, it's not quite fair to ask that question in terms of just who's consuming energy, end of story. Why? Because a lot of the energy that we consume is, we say, embodied in the goods that we purchase. So if we buy something manufactured in China and it required energy to manufacture that product in China, is China responsible for the energy that it took to make that product, or is the consumer the purchaser of the product? And so this graph here takes into account the cross-border transport of goods and the embodied energy in those goods. Wow. Yeah, I'm not gonna say any more. I think the graph says it all, right? Yeah, that's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. Now, this is, by the way, per capita, and there are way fewer people in Canada, too. So that's one mitigating factor, though, yeah. It does make you wonder a little about Canada, though, doesn't it? Yeah. The next statistic I'm going to put here just for fun, because it was brought up if you've been attending Jeff Cagey's sessions in the mornings at 10:30. We talked about GMOs and nuclear energy in terms of scientific communication. And I just think this is kind of interesting. If you look at safest and cleanest source of energy, coal loses every single time. It results in a lot of deaths due to accidents and air pollution, and it generates the most greenhouse gases. Oil does a little better, but frankly, not that much. Natural gas has far fewer deaths, but still an awful lot of greenhouse gases. Biomass energy is tricky because it's so variable depending on the type of biomass. But look at this. Which one creates the least greenhouse gases?
Nuclear.
Which one has the fewest deaths?
Nuclear.
Second, solar. Yeah, solar. But it's a pretty much dead tie, right? So fascinating, right? Yeah.
There's a proposal that we could take all the rigs that are fragmenting and getting oil that way and dig them deeper, and we get thermal energy all over the country where they are.
Yeah, I've seen that recently. So this idea of getting a deep ground thermal energy for electricity is really compelling. I've got some colleagues who are like, I had some students like, hey, Professor so-and-so was saying this in the class, and then another student came to me, and they kept over talking about this, and it turned out it was all the same professor. But yeah, it's getting a lot of airplay right now. It's very interesting. Yeah.
So the accidents and deaths, that includes the people who extract the resources too?
Absolutely, yes. And that's why coal is so shockingly high.
Coal miners and uranium miners are both included in this.
I would presume uranium miners are in here, yes. And it does include deaths from Chernobyl and Fukushima. Well, the death from Fukushima, we're at one so far. Right.
It's causing a lot of cancer among the Navajo.
And that's why I sincerely hope that deaths and disability-adjusted life years, dailies we call them, which is health impacts that aren't fatal. I hope that those are included because, yes, there is a real environmental justice concern because so many of the impacts of uranium mining have been disproportionately borne by Native Americans. Absolutely. So thank you for mentioning that. Yeah.
How does solar have more greenhouse emissions than nuclear?
From manufacturing. Right?
And mining.
And mining, yeah. The actual creating the silica for single crystal silica panels is a highly intensive process. So it's kind of fascinating. I don't know. Not really related to the SDGs. I was inspired to put that on there because of Jeff's talk.
I think it's important as people think, let's go back to coal.
Right.
We have a senator paid for by the coal industry in our country.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. At least one. One that we know of that comes to mind anyway. Right. Let's look at keep on moving forward. Sustainable cities and communities. This is kind of amazing. More than 4 billion people live in urban areas globally. That's now more than half of all people in the world live in an urban environment. Wow. This is the importance of SDG 11, actually, is because as the world becomes increasingly urbanized, by 2050, it's expected that close to 7 billion people will live in urban areas, two-thirds of the population. We need to seriously look at the way our cities are designed and built so that they are not only energy efficient, but humane and sustainable. Right now, that's not such a good statistic. 9 out of 10 urban residents breathe polluted air. That's a pretty rotten statistic. 1 out of 4 urban residents live in slum-like conditions as of 2018. Only half of urban residents have access to public transit. It's really important in terms of employment opportunities, right? And there are certainly a large disparity, even in this country, about who has access to public transit and what forms of public transit. Do we build rail lines, light rail lines, through more vulnerable, economically disadvantaged communities? No, we build light rail lines through more affluent communities where we expect maybe a higher payback on capital, whereas lower income communities are more often relegated to using buses, right? So, And finally, 16 here, peace, justice, and strong institutions. I had to add this figure here because most of them were pretty discouraging, right? So we look at human trafficking. 70% of known victims of human trafficking are women and girls, most of whom are trafficked for sexual exploitation. Men make up around 80% of homicide victims, but women constitute 64% of homicide victims of intimate partner and family-related homicide. So these are really very sobering statistics. On the other hand, if you look at deaths in state-based conflicts, that is, wars from 1946 to 2020, we see a few conflicts here. Let's see if anyone can name the conflicts. That's after.
Korea.
Vietnam.
Iran.
Iraq. And both Iraq and Afghanistan. Yep. So both. And then.
What about all the wars in Africa?
This is inclusive of all. But deaths per 100,000. Those are going to make some of these interruptions in the baseline here. The reason I pointed out the density of the conflicts is how many of those has the United States been an active participant in? Most of them. Right? Active or indirect, right? Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, not the first Afghanistan, but Iraq, certainly. But the numbers, the trend is certainly strongly downhill, and that in itself is a bit, and that, remember, leaves off the world wars, which would be substantially higher, right? I didn't include those, but those would be substantially higher. So are we making progress?
Jim, can you say what the color code is on that?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So this is, no, not there I can't, but here I certainly can.
Civil complex is the blue.
Yeah.
Civil complex with...
So colonial or imperial conflicts are in green. Conflicts between states are in light purple. Civil conflicts within a country are in bright red here. And then civil conflicts with transnational, with foreign states. So these are between states. Within states. Yeah. So, yeah.
We have to mention that a lot of between states are instigated by other countries outside of those states.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. This is why I wanted to remind myself to stop. I feel like this a lot of times when I get in front of a class. Just stop me. Okay. What I want to do for a bit is I want to you to look through the most recent data, and I'm going to break you into we have eight, right? So we'll just break you into, so I'm just going to hand these out to a person, and as we go along, and maybe one or two or three of you will nucleate around that person, and oops, this goes with yours, sorry, and as we move forward, and I'm missing one. So find one or two people around you that you would like to talk to. And what I want you to do with these is, and I totally forgot the slide where I asked the questions. So I will have, thank you for coming down. Sorry, I did not include you up there. So I forgot to include the slide with the questions. What I want you to do is identify a statistic or two. Maybe the two of you can get together.
Yes.
Yes. So what I'd like you to do as your groups nucleate here is just two things. I want you to look for two things. I want you to identify on the front side of the sheet where it has the nice, the small icon of the SDG that looks like this. I want you to identify one or two statistics that you feel may have been impacted by COVID since the data you just saw, right? And on the back side, which is the larger SDG icon in the bulleted, in the numbered list. I want you to read through this and get a sense of what the actual targets are within the goals. And you'll notice that each goal has maybe 4 or 5 targets, up to maybe a dozen targets. And I want you to just maybe note 1 or 2 targets that you find interesting. And at the end of this process, you're going to simply, for each of the groups, you're going to simply say, this is one of the trends or statistics we found interesting, and here are a couple targets that we thought were sort of indicative about what this goal means, right? So those are the only 2 things you need to get out of this, okay? And then we'll just go around the room, and you can let us know what you find, okay?
Okay, let's drop back together now, and we're just going to go through our goals here from 1 to 16 to review.
Whoa. Yikes. Oh. Better. Okay. To review, you're going to highlight one of the trends that, or at least one of the trends that you thought was impacted by COVID. On the back, you're going to talk about 1 or 2 of the targets that helps you understand what the meaning of the goal is. Let's go with SDG 1, first of all.
So we have SDG 1, which is end poverty in all its forms everywhere. We had an easy question on what's been impacted by COVID because right at the top of our sheet it says more than 4 years of progress against poverty has been erased by COVID-19. So Christine called that a POCA, that we do 2 steps forward and 2 steps back. Yeah. And on the backside, in terms of the goals, something that really stood out to us related to, well, so it says, by 2030, build the resilience of the poor and those in vulnerable situations and reduce their exposure and vulnerability to climate-related extreme events and other economic, social, and environmental shocks and disasters. And so we were thinking about climate refugees and how already we're seeing impacts of that, and how that has multiple reasons that are causes for it, and then how that expands in lots of different ways. And so being able to aim at those climate-related refugees and hoping to reduce that and impacting poverty.
Thank you. Thank you, Team Pastor. All right. SDG 2.
That sounded like you had about 3 months of preparation. You did really well. We have number 2, which is zero hunger. And on one of the items on the front included soaring food prices were affected. 47% of the countries in 2020. And without question, the COVID protocols, you know, there were shutdowns and there were food, a zillion things related to COVID stopped the productions. We've got supply chain interruptions and all kinds of things. So that definitely had an impact negatively on dealing efficiently with food distribution and et cetera. On the back, there were probably about 8 to 10 little items on it. And I think we picked out one that talked about to maintain the genetic diversity of seeds, cultivated plants, and farmed and domesticated animals and their related wild species, soundly managing and diversified seed plant banks at national. Having some coordinated elements that seeds are able to get to places where they can be planted and good seed management and livestock management. We don't know exactly what all of that is, but we figured that probably related.
Great. Yeah, you're all choosing really fascinating, sort of intriguing targets for those goals. Who had SDG 3? Who would take the mic for that? Thank you, Steve.
Okay, so it's the goal is to ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all ages. Of course, the number of deaths from COVID would affect that. But I thought that the longest term impact would come from the halted progress on universal health coverage. If that's an umbrella thing talking about availability of health care, for, because that impacts many of the things on the top. The first two have to do with maternal mortality and deaths of newborns and children, and certainly access to health care is maybe the biggest factor in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Who had SDG 4? Can I give that to you? Thank you.
Well, we were naughty. We discussed personal experiences rather than particular points. I think we agreed that part of my conversation partner mentioned that, was it your son or your daughter, that any one of her children probably won't return to school because they never adjusted to the distance learning and won't return to school. And I know there's a number of that, but I think our basic concern is that that more people be included in school. That's 4.2. Nationally and internationally, and we're aware that it's primarily a cost factor in most cases, that people either have inadequate schools or they aren't able to go as far as they're capable of going, and that would require that we shift money from, in this country, our military budget, I think, to our educational budget. We're losing a lot of teachers because they can't afford to live in the areas where they're supposed to be teaching.
Right. Okay, great. Moving on to SDG 5. Yes?
I was just going to say, I read a really interesting story about Black families whose kids stayed home, you know, like they really did. And they ended up really feeling way more comfortable and successful doing that and forming groups with other Black people. And it's like the amount of homeschooling Black people tripled or more. And that was a super positive thing for them. And they're just going to stay, keep doing it because they realized how...
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating, fascinating. We will be studying the impacts, positive and negative, right, of COVID on our educational system and all of our other systems for, I think, years to come. Yeah. SDG 5. Go, Sarah. You got this.
We decided that one of the things that could have been affected by COVID was that women accounted for 45% of global employment losses in 2020, and that might have been because that woman was staying home, and a lot of people lost jobs and such things.
Some points that we thought were like very important to Goal 5 were like ensuring women's full and effective participation and equal opportunities for leadership at all levels in decision making in political, economic, and public life, because politics is kind of how a lot of things get, like things happen in governments all around the world, and so if women are more equally represented in politics, then by effect, they'll be able to make a lot of changes for a lot of the other goals on the list. So that one was like one thing that we thought was really important.
Great, great. Okay, 7.
We're 7, but I also was thinking about, you're talking about the drop in employment. A lot of women and a lot of people, you know, were doing other jobs. I mean, the stuff that I read, there was lots of changes in jobs and salaries were going up because, I mean, you know, or pay was going up because people were desperate and so they switched jobs. You know, I mean, there's just, you know, there may have been 40% who stopped, but there were also a lot who decided maybe to do online things or whatever. And so it's not, I think it's not quite as bad as it looks. And for some people it's better, you know, that they quit their jobs or whatever. But anyway, we had electricity. I'll do this one. The things we thought about with electricity, with power and stuff, we thought that there were really good things, like you're saying, you know, people weren't commuting right anymore. Mm-hmm. Everyone was staying home, so you had a whole lot of cars off the road. Mm-hmm. And the giant office buildings or any office buildings, they weren't turning on their electricity and their air conditioning or heating or whatever, all the costs of that stuff, they're just empty, you know. So that was a really helpful thing. Is there anything else on here that we talked about?
Well, it's kind of between,
Theirs
and ours.
They have that one, yeah.
And
One thing we did talk about was also that there has been kind of a slowing down of progress in renewable energy technologies related to supply chain issues, like manufacture of solar panels to convert homes, for instance. That's a tiny little thing, but it's one thing that's related. Yeah.
And then in these, the goals, do we have anything on that?
Okay, on to 11. Is this, which, what are you?
I have 11.
Okay, let's bring it up to 11 over here.
Okay, this is sustainable cities. So one was waste, and we thought waste probably got... Dr. Bolter, how many pounds of synthetic material have been consumed in the last 2 years for masks? Oh, I don't expect you to know that. That's a lot of garbage. Yeah. And then takeout food. Yeah. And just it, and all of the additional single-use packaging that's been implemented. And another one was access to public transportation. So a lot of places, transportation's been severely waylaid because people didn't use it, but the people who need it didn't matter to the, you know, wealthy Wall Street people working from home. They never took the subway anyway. But and then you, I think you also mentioned you couldn't find drivers for transit systems.
In Portland, the buses have $7,500 sign-up fee.
So
just
even lack of, even if there's the ability to have the bus or the train, there aren't people to drive them. In terms of general concept, it's really, and this is completely, as living in the U.S., this is a total absolute scientific fantasy, but a planned city that incorporated useful transportation that was available to people and included green space and took into account, like, maybe let's not build it below sea level or right where the earthquake's going to, or the hurricane's going to make landfill. And also, I think it's important to think that an electric car, I know a lot of people here from live in the Seattle area, I don't think, you know, an electric vehicle is going to make getting through that little tunnel on I-5 downtown any better. And I live in the Bay Area. It's not going to, that's not going to solve traffic, right? So I think that's what a well-designed city could do.
Right. Okay, great. And now we'll end with peace, justice, and governance.
Okay. Well, during COVID, you know, here it talks about 100 million people have been forcibly displaced worldwide. Now, this was from May 2022, so we all know what happened in March, right?
Yeah.
So what you think, at least came to my mind, is that was probably reflecting the war in Ukraine. But during COVID, my feeling was, I'm not sure if COVID was really displacing us.
What about South America and the immigration crisis on the border?
Right. Yeah. Right,
but that was pre-COVID as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
did COVID help that or not is a good question.
Yeah.
I don't think it probably helped.
I don't think it helped.
No.
I wonder if the biggest impact on this has to do with negatively affecting people's trust in institutions and government.
Mm. Uh-huh. Yes, right.
Yeah, interesting. Right. Definitely.
And then... we didn't get to talk a lot about what was on the back, but just reading through these as we were sitting here, my feeling at least was to promote just, peaceful, and inclusive societies. Promote the rule of law at national and international levels and ensure equal access to justice for all. I felt that was most important to help us along that way. There were other ideas here that might work as well, but that one really went out for me.
Okay. Right. Yeah, so some of these, as Michael Green mentioned, right, are very concrete and maybe very measurable, and others... are less obvious in terms of how we can measure them and how we can get an accurate representation on our progress. One of the things that you saw at the beginning of this is the reference that was made to the social progress indicator. And I want to just, we're almost out of time here, but I did want to show you Something about the social progress indicator. So the social progress indicator is, and I'll skip the video for this, but why is that not projecting? Oh, that's why. There we go. So there are a bunch of indicators. So you take all of those, we have to take the 16 or 17 goals, you take all the indicators, 169 indicators, targets for those, and all the hundreds of indicators that are related, that are basically related to a data stream. And in the end, you get to, you can group those quantitative measures and create indices. And there's a bunch of indices like that. And one of them is the social progress indicator. And why I start with the United States here, I think, is really interesting, is because, you know, we have this, and again, Jeff talked about this in his scientific communication exercise. One of the mythologies that we live with is the mythology of American exceptionalism, right? And we look at the social progress indicator here, and we can actually go ahead and open up the website, I think.
We have some number ones.
We do, but what's interesting is, no, I don't want to sign up for updates right now. We can look at a map around the world of values of the social progress indicator, which again is involves a lot of these measures or these indicators we talked about, and I'm still projecting the wrong thing. Okay, stop projection. Getting myself in trouble. Here we go. So here's a map of the social progress index around the world. And of course, you can look at any one of these and you might say, well, so how's Germany doing? And you can see, right, so it's a scale from 0 to 100 and meeting basic human needs, foundation of well-being and opportunities. And you can look at their scorecard and you can see where they're doing well. Whether it's a strength or a weakness, access to information and communications, health and wellness, environmental quality, access to advanced information, education, inclusiveness. And we can now look at a range of countries and sort of see how they are relative to each other. Even something like access to improved sanitation. We can see the rank, we're at 42, and it's a relative weakness, right? We're underperforming by more than 1 point on that particular thing, and that might come as a big surprise. We can look around the world and so now we're in India. And we see the overall, and we look at the value there, and they're ranked 115 out of 168. We can compare countries. That's not what I wanted. We can compare countries here. I won't do that right now. So that's just one indicator. I think there are, as I said to you, there are some other indicators that I think are fascinating as well. There is the Human Development Index, which is actually United Nations. And this one I appreciate because it has a nice listed ranking. This is purely on elements that are in terms of social. So the environmental quality that we saw in the social progress indicator are not present. And again, we can see what countries are, and it's kind of confusing because it reads across. So Norway, Switzerland, Ireland, Hong Kong, Iceland, Germany, and so forth. We see here the United States is ranked 17. And we get a sense that, you know what, these sustainable development goals are really not just pointed at the rest of the world where we see, you know, what's wrong with you, other country, look at us, try and be more like us. We see the ways in which these sustainable development goals really, in all honesty, apply to the United States too. We can look up, as I said, the sustainable development goal database. Here, again, we can see rankings of countries where it's actually, where each of the SDGs is listed. And then finally, I wanted to show some really fascinating indicators here where we look at it regionally, where the target is almost met down to very far from target. And we can look at each of the SDGs. How are we doing in not only the goal, but at least one or two of its targets? For example, if we're looking at health, ensure healthy lives and promote well-being of all ages. We can look across the world. We can see where the global average is. We can look at other countries and see how we are doing in developed countries versus right parts of Africa or Asia. We can look at malaria, diphtheria. So there's all kinds of wealth of data out there. But
is there another column to the right for lesser developed countries?
There is not. That's the extent of it. I don't know why that is the case. That's interesting, isn't it? Let me just verify that, because I took this out of a PDF file. And it's possible. No, that is indeed the full report there. So the reason I show these is it's really easy, I think, historically for us as Americans to sort of look at the rest of the world and say, what are ways in which you need to catch up? And instead of looking at ourselves, looking inward and saying, what are ways that we could be doing better for our own citizens? How are we doing on governance? How are we doing on health? How are we doing on gender equity? How are we doing on some of the other availability of clean and renewable energy for all? So I think it's a really good indicator for us to really look closely at ourselves and sort of ask the very hard questions that relate to our identity as a nation and as a people. And I think that's where I will end this because we are out of time, but I will certainly welcome any questions that you all have. And those of you who want to head off to dinner, I welcome to do that now. So thank you. Yes.
Is it really possible for us doing better for ourselves without the rest of the world doing better?
I think so. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? Some of the things that require that will lead to better scores on the Sustainable Development Goals and the Social Progress Index really can be accomplished by without any additional cost. Things like gender equity can be influenced by appropriate federal or state or local policies that may not require us to compete. Right, with other countries. So on one hand, if we look at remittances to other countries from the developed world to the developing world, helping them to do better on some of these indicators, giving them assistance, that requires a lot of money, right? Can we make improvements on ourselves without sort of diverting that monetary stream?
What about us not flooding their markets with cheap wheat?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. So there's a lot of there's a lot of policies that could be done that would be beneficial to the developing world as well. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
I think it's just part of our deep-rooted colonial kind of like. That we have a tendency to think here, look to the other world and say, you need to be more like him. We can help you to do that instead of concerning ourselves. And how are we not meeting those goals? I think both and can occur.
I think both and is really important. On one hand, and I'll cast this in terms of the field of this I know best, which is climate. Do we need to be performing better as a country in transition to renewable energy? Yes. Do we need to provide loss and damage payments to the developing world who are already suffering from a changing climate that we have substantially contributed to? Yeah, we need to do that too, right? And in the end, is there an economic payback for making those appropriate decisions? Yeah, there is, because we know for a fact that if we look at future emissions of CO2 throughout the rest of the century, increasingly those are coming from the developing world as it gains more economic clout and consumes.